This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America on this edition of the program, The Syrian Conundrum. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. Who would have thought that back in 2011, the peaceful protests in Syria in the context of the Arab Spring would have resulted in the carnage and regional proxy power struggle we are witnessing today? When Syrian President Bashar al-Assad turned on his own people, placed snipers on rooftops, and shot them in the streets, rather than make reasonable political compromises, thousands of Syrian security forces defected and crossed the border into Turkey to form the Free Syria Army, or FSA, and civilians formed coordinating councils to defend their lives. Fast forward to today. Since the end of September 2015, both Moscow and Tehran have aggressively ramped up their efforts to shore up Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. The vast majority of the Russian airstrikes have targeted the mainstream opposition and not the so-called Islamic State, seen as enemy number one by the United States. U.S. efforts to persuade Russia to target the Islamic State have gone unheeded. Meantime, the Syrian conflict has spawned the biggest refugee crisis since World War II, threatening the fabric of the European Union. The death toll, pegged at 250,000, has surely soared well past that. More than half the citizens of the nation of 22 million have been forced from their homes. Jordan, Turkey, and Lebanon, who have taken in many refugees, are at a breaking point. The most recent talks aimed at reaching a cessation of hostilities have once again broken down. With us to discuss why Syria spiraled out of control and the consequences of our actions or inactions are Ambassador James Jeffrey. He's former ambassador to Iraq and Turkey, now a distinguished fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. That's a think tank here in Washington. And Aaron Stein. He's a senior fellow in the Rafiq Hariri Center for the Middle East at the Atlantic Council. That's a policy group also based here in Washington. And both gentlemen join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center. Welcome to the program. Well, Mr. Ambassador, let me begin with you to get your take on the situation so far. 5 years, we've seen the situation deteriorate in Syria. We've had talks in Geneva, Vienna, now Munich, either for cessation of hostilities or to try to come to a political resolution. But here we are. What are your thoughts?
First of all, well, I can be as critical as anybody else. You have to begin by acknowledging that this was a very, very difficult problem under any circumstances from the get-go, and that intervening in any sort of civil conflict, insurgency, you name it, after the experiences in Iraq and Afghanistan, and frankly, although it was at the same time, the less than happy result of our intervention in Libya, I can have some understanding. Nonetheless, what we missed was two things. First of all, that like Bosnia in the 1990s, and there are a lot of similarities, this thing would just get worse and worse if we didn't act, and that sooner or later the pressure to act, if only for humanitarian reasons, by hundreds of thousands of people killed, would be enormous. The second thing we missed, which was even more difficult to understand, is that we live in a different world today than we did in that happy period of the 1990s and the first decade plus of this century, where we didn't really have geopolitics on a global scale like we had during the Cold War, like we had during World War II, because America and the Western nation-state system was dominant ideologically, economically, and most importantly, militarily. That has all changed with the rise of Russia, China, and regional problem children such as North Korea and Iran, who to one extent or another are allied with, are exploiting relationships with China and Russia. And that's exactly what has happened. It's not just Bosnia on steroids, although it is that. It is also a tinderbox for a possible global competition and global conflict of the sort of, to stay with Balkan analogies, Bosnia-Herzegovina in 1914, not 1995.
Turning to you, Aaron Stein, for your take on where we are today with respect to Syria, had the United States, the West, perhaps not necessarily sent ground forces, but intervened in some way more vigorously to support the rebel opposition who rose up against Bashar al-Assad peacefully. And now, as Ambassador Jeffrey has said, we are looking at potentially a Bosnia on steroids. We have the Russians now, the Iranians backing Bashar al-Assad. How do you see where we are today?
And what you're seeing inside Syria is the emergence of two parallel conflicts, one in which the Russians, the Iranians, the Syrian regime are fighting against what we would call the anti-Assad insurgents or the rebel opposition. Some of that rebel opposition we like, some of which we don't. And that war is going pretty poorly for us, and that's really in the northwestern part of Syria. Whereas in the northeastern part of Syria is where you have U.S. intervention, and it's on a level only against the Islamic State and meant to enforce or at least to meet the administration's two goals, which is simply to defeat and degrade ISIS and then allegedly, seems like, to pack up and leave once it's over. And then while this concurrent stuff happens in Geneva, the peace talks. So as Ambassador Jeffrey said, you have this geopolitical tensions that are going on right now where these two wars are divergent. And so while you may have success against the war in ISIS in the eastern part of Syria, your war in the western part is going poorly, which is in strengthening the Assad position, strengthening the Russian position. And so you have very little leverage to try and bring about an end to the conflict in a political manner, in a peaceful manner, like the administration would like to.
Well, back to you, Ambassador Jeffrey. You know, you authored an op-ed in the Washington Post, you know, in which you said, look, it's time now, you know, for the creation of a safe zone, which would require a no-fly zone. But again and again, the U.S. administration has balked or reneged on doing something like this that could have shored up the mainstream rebels, protected civilians, could have prevented this enormous outflow of refugees. Is that even still on the table, in your view, and could that work today, even though it's very late in the day?
It's still on the table. I also co-authored it. Ambassador Nick Burns was also involved. It's still possible today. It's more difficult because the Russians are there, and it would require tough diplomacy to avoid an incident, but it's doable. You know, the Russians intervened in an area chock-a-block full of American and allied weaponry, and we could do a much less intrusive intervention than not. The other thing that we'd do, and it's very important both legally and in the sense of what Aaron has talked about, the two conflicts, it would block the last 60 miles where ISIS is able to infiltrate people, weapons, money, and other things in from the north. So it has a multitude of different goals, but at bottom, it basically puts us back in the game, focusing not just on ISIS, which is important, but also on dealing with this Assad, Iran, Russian, Hezbollah front that is building up before our eyes. That's the more dangerous problem in the whole Middle East, and it's also one of the major factors that's fueling ISIS. Because if nobody else can fight these guys, ISIS can, and Sunni Arabs and potentially Sunni states and Turkey will start looking at that if this coalition led by Russia and Iran keeps winning.
Turning to you, Aaron Stein, for your take on Ambassador Jeffrey and Ambassador Nicholas Burns' recommendation that it's time to take the lead in Syria, that the United States, with NATO help, should create a safe zone for all the reasons Ambassador Jeffrey just elaborated.
I mean, well, I agree on the reasons. I mean, what I see is that you would be trading potential escalation with the Russians in exchange for creating a safe zone opposite the small sliver of the Turkish territory. So you would be risking a larger war for a smaller political gain inside Syria. So what I would counsel is something just slightly different. It's a take on the safe zone issue, but it's taking advantages of the areas where there already is basically a de facto safe zone inside Syria, which is over much of the northern Kurdish areas and in where the U.S. is very active in the eastern part of Syria as a means with which to perhaps put in allied ground troops, either Saudi, Jordanian, Emirati, or even Turkish, as a way to then either put pressure on the regime to either take the anti-ISIS coalition more seriously and make more concessions on the concurrent political track, or, you know, in a more extreme way, you could even think of using this as a base of operations to then begin to blunt what, you know, the Iran, Hezbollah, Russian access that's coming at these guys from the western part of the country. So not actually go in on the side of the Turkish border, but perhaps where we're already most active and where Russian planes aren't flying, basically codifying the lines that are already in place, and then using that as a means to try and put more pressure on the Assad regime.
Turning back to you, Ambassador Jeffrey, sort of a historical if question. Do you think had the United States and the West either implemented a safe zone earlier, would the Russians have felt emboldened to come in September of last year, where they came in full force backing Bashar al-Assad with troops and an air force?
They might have. We really can't assess that. There is no single answer to dealing with him. It's not that toughness always works. It's not that falling back in negotiation always leads him to push forward. You have to look at what his interests are in the circumstances. It's quite possible that had we gone in and set up a safe zone, as people have been recommending for years now, that he would have made that intervention sooner. But that's okay, because we're not out there to destroy the Syrian state, to drive the Russians into the sea from their base that they've had for decades, and to essentially turn Syria over to this group of Sunni rebels, some of whom are pretty unpleasant people. What we're trying to do is to get a ceasefire and get some sort of political process that will allow the vast majority of that country, the moderates, if you will, who are both Sunni Arab and some of them are Alawites and some of them are Christians, to be able to come together, stop the fighting, and not let this be a mini volcano that engulfs the entire Middle East, which is the way it's heading now.
Turning back to you, Ehrenstein, Ambassador Jeffrey brings up a very interesting point. He talks about enabling the United States, the West, to have essentially more leverage at the negotiating table, not necessarily to defeat Bashar al-Assad. What do you think about that argument? Some are saying right now we're talking with the Russians, with the Iranians, and so on, but we're really not getting anywhere. And many analysts are saying it's because we don't have any battlefield strategy. The mainstream rebels that we have supported, and as Ambassador Jeffrey said, some of whom perhaps are not great actors, but nonetheless, they are the forefront of defeating ISIL as well as weakening the Assad regime. Some are saying that simply that we are ceding ground to the Russians, the Iranians, and the Syrians because we have no leverage on the ground. They are being pummeled by the Syrian regime thanks to Russian airstrikes, and it seems like the only people winning are ISIL, the so-called Islamic State, and the Syrian regime.
Well, I don't think ISIL is winning. Actually, if you were to look at the way that the war is progressing in the eastern part of the country, I actually think ISIL is losing. But, you know, the Syrian war is very complicated. You know, as of March 2015 last year, the regime seemed to be on its last legs. U.S. was supporting a myriad of groups operating in North Aleppo. The problem is that those groups often bandwagon with the groups that we don't like. And so when they fight with those groups that we don't like, we got our hands pretty dirty in that the program to arm some of these rebel groups did indirectly help a lot of the people that we will eventually have to go and target. I'm thinking about Syria's al-Qaeda franchise being the most obvious one of that.
Al-Nusra Front.
Al-Nusra Front. And the gains made on the battlefield do appear to have prompted Russian intervention. Now, it doesn't seem like we had a plan B. And the Russians have a very simple strategy that they have to entail. It's simply to prop up Bashar al-Assad. And then as they move into negotiations to fracture and weaken an already fractured and weak anti-Assad opposition. So he's not done yet. I mean, if you look at Putin's actions inside Syria, he has more things to do. It's to encircle Aleppo and it's to push all the way up to the Syrian border. When that happens, you know, I guess the hope is that he would go back to the negotiating table and be willing to cut a deal. Now, I think what Ambassador Jeffrey is rightly pointing out is, well, what do we come to the table with at that point? And that's an open question, absent escalation on the U.S. side. And a lot of people are counseling against that for the obvious reasons of, well, you don't want to empower some of these groups on the ground, and you don't want to risk confrontations with the Russians over events on the ground inside Syria.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Ambassador James Jeffrey. He's former ambassador to Iraq and Turkey, now a distinguished fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, and Ehrenstein, from whom you just heard. He's a senior fellow in the Rafiq Hariri Center for the Middle East at the Atlantic Council. And we're talking about the conflicting strategic interests in Syria and what it will take to end the carnage. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel, VOA, or connect with us on Facebook. Well, back to you, Ambassador Jeffrey, to go back again historically to look at where we came from and how we got to where we are today, this horrible conflict. A question about the so-called Iran deal. Many analysts are saying now that, well, while this conflict was going on, the United States was engaged with the other major world powers in negotiating the nuclear deal with Iran. And some are suggesting that perhaps that the United States simply prioritized the Iran deal over the Syrian conflict, that perhaps we didn't act more aggressively because we didn't want to do anything to jeopardize the Iran deal. Do you think that there's some merit to that argument?
There is, but only in an indirect way. The culprit in this mystery is not the Iran deal. In and of itself, the Iran deal is a modest transactional. We end sanctions, another pain on you, Iran, if you push your nuclear breakout capability back from a couple of months to roughly a year. In and of itself, not bad. The problem is the Iran deal was wrapped up, and I hate to leave the region, but I'll give you the best example I can cite, which is the president's foolhardy trip to Cuba. What is behind all of this is an ideological belief that if you reach out to and build trust with hostile, dictatorial, regional hegemon wannabe states, they will change their spots and be nice. It will be another Nixon goes to China moment. That was the second motivation driving the administration in that period, not just to get an Iran deal, but then to leverage the Iran deal for a different Middle East. In a vague, strange way, it was a little like President George W. Bush's idea of invade Iraq, get democracy, and change the entire Middle East. We've had two presidents who've had these dreams of transformation on the cheap. Only they're not on the cheap. So that's the problem with the Iran deal. We were afraid not that it would bollocks up the actual negotiations, but this presumed transformation where all the cool kids in Tehran take over the state and the society and become our best buddies in the region. And of course, that hasn't happened. In fact, it has gone dramatically the other way ever since the deal was signed.
Turning to you, Ehrenstein, for your take on what the Iran deal, if anything, has to do with where we are today in Syria.
I don't think it has much to do at all. I agree. I think that they are two different issues. I mean, the Iran deal is a very good, actually, if you ask me, non-proliferation arrangement. If you just look at it in what did it set out to do, did it achieve those ends, and will Iran have the capability to construct a nuclear weapon in the next decade to even two decades? And the answer is no. The negotiations coincided with the increase in American covert action inside Syria. So if there's anything that it did do, I mean, I think that they were pushed off into two different cubbyholes of American diplomacy during that time. However, I don't think that once it was rolled out and then it became time to sell the deal to the American public, it created the impression of the Americans cozying up to Iran, particularly in the region. And it has fueled suspicion of American policy goals inside of Syria, particularly amongst our closest allies. And I'm thinking Saudi Arabia and Turkey being the two most obvious candidates. And so it made it more difficult for us to work with them on our preferred policy solutions. The Iran deal simply made a difficult situation more difficult because our policy options are already widely divergent before the Iran deal came out and then the way the administration tried to sell it.
And that leads me to ask you, Ambassador Jeffrey, whether or not this is true with respect to the way the United States negotiated the Iran deal. But it looks like Russia and Iran have no qualms about talking and, you know, acting on the ground at the same time, talking nice, but then again in Syria, pursuing their interests, which is destroying the rebel opposition, any form of opposition to the Assad regime. But what about the United States? We seem to be talking, but not doing concomitant actions on the ground in any way that could shore up our position at the negotiating table. Do you agree with that? How do you see it?
No, I agree with that, but I think it flows from two parallel, mutually reinforcing positions of this administration that I followed for years. First is a deep belief that military force, whether we use it or anybody else uses it, will achieve nothing. President's first reaction when Putin went into Ukraine was essentially quagmire. His specific reaction, because he used exactly that word, when the Russians went into Syria was the same thing. And it's not that the president was trying to fool the American people because he didn't want to take action. I think he truly believes this. I'm sure of it. The second thing is, what he does believe in is the idea of, to quote Kerry, who believes it in a somewhat different way, that negotiations are the alternative to military force. This isn't true as a professional diplomat. Military force, other elements of hard and soft power, are the tools with which you organize a result through diplomacy, through talking. You need these tools. If you don't have these tools, what you're basically saying is that talking and outreach and, quote, building trust is an end in and of itself and is so enormously attractive in an almost physical, passionate sense that other sides, be it Castro, be it the Iranian Ayatollahs, be it Putin, will change their spots and suddenly decide this is a different direction. We can be America's best guy friend and stop doing the bad things they're doing. It's not happening anywhere.
Turning to you, Ehrenstein, to comment on what Ambassador Jeffrey just said, you know, talking is an end in itself. It does seem that that is the operating principle for the U.S. administration, particularly Secretary of State John Kerry. But I've heard other analysts say, and many of the mainstream opposition rebels in Syria are saying, you know, that in order for them to have the leverage they need at the negotiating table, they need to have greater backing, whether military or otherwise, from the United States, and they need the United States to help be a convener and to corral many of the other allies, whether it's Saudi Arabia or Turkey, to get on the same page.
What Putin is doing exactly what Ambassador Jeffrey is saying. He is shaping the battlefield so that his preferred negotiation stance will have more salience in a couple of months. Now, when you flip it again to the United States side, John Kerry has a far more difficult job than Vladimir Putin. He's not dealing with a state. He's dealing with a group of rebels. You know, these group of rebels are divided. They're able to come together and coalesce around certain ideas, but it's hard for them to stay together and come up with a very specific negotiating principle that is in line with what the U.S. actually wants, which is a phased transition so that the government doesn't collapse. And so it becomes very difficult on the U.S. side to shape the opposition, to shape your negotiating points, and then to shape and corral all of the actors involved in the conflict. Would more military force have helped to do this? I think that's debatable, actually. I think it would have helped. The idea of military force would be gain leverage over the regime to make concessions.
Back to you, Ambassador Jeffrey. Again, another historical question. But I recall back in 2012 and then in 2013, we had inflection points at which point the United States and its allies. I remember France had jets on the tarmac in 2013 when President Obama said there was a red line when we ascertained that Bashar al-Assad used chemical weapons on his own people, that we would not tolerate that. But then we went back, we did a deal with Russia to remove the chemical weapons instead of striking Bashar al-Assad's air force. And then in 2012, you recall cabinet members Leon Panetta, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, and CIA Chief General David Petraeus said, we really need to step up our support of the rebel opposition. Again, we demurred. That is, the administration, President Obama, decided not to follow advice. Could any of those actions have made a difference today, in your view?
Yes. Again, I have some sympathy for President Obama in 2012, given the problems with the recommendation to do a surge in Afghanistan, given the inability to keep troops on in Iraq, given the denouement in Libya, for not wanting to get involved in a deeper civil war, supposedly on the cheap. I wish he had done that. I wish he had listened to them. But I have some sympathy for him. Where I have absolutely no sympathy for him, and where I think we're talking about a historic inflection point, was the decision not to execute the red line. This would not have involved his usual fears to the American public of a decade of war, thousands of casualties, hundreds and thousands of troops on the ground. It would have involved a set of surgical strikes. In the end, they may not have done all of that much. The point is, what this president does not get, and this is becoming fatal for all of us, is that we are at the very center of a global system. It has financial, banking, economic, trade, legal, philosophical, humanitarian elements in it. But at the very center is the security guarantee that we give directly to indirectly to more than half the countries in the world. And that is based upon a belief that when we say we will act, and particularly when there's real justification for it, and it was real justification for what that war criminal was doing, and then we step aside when nobody can understand why. What were we afraid of? There were no Russian jets. There were very limited Syrian surface-to-air missiles. Why did he do that? And everything since then has simply reinforced this idea that this guy is not playing the global security role. And people who are taking advantage of that, we can see that from Ukraine to South China Sea, now to Syria.
And one last question for you, Ambassador Jeffrey. Do you see the presence of Bashar al-Assad and his backers, Iran, Hezbollah, and, of course, Russia now? Is he, in a sense, one of the root causes of the rise of ISIS, whom the United States sees as our biggest enemy?
Yes, he is. And he is also become a symbol of this growing dominance of Iran and Russia in the Middle East. Thus, as long as he's there, the Sunni Arab states and Turkey are going to find a way to push back. And without us guiding them, restraining them, and leading them, that is going to produce an even more dangerous Middle East.
I'm afraid on that pessimistic note, that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guest, Ambassador James Jeffrey. He's a distinguished fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, and Aaron Stein, senior fellow at the Rafiq Hariri Center for the Middle East at the Atlantic Council. Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Cornelius Tenner. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.